Welcome to How Positive Are You, Episode 17. I'm your guest host, Terry Michael, in Washington, D.C., joining regular co-host Celia Farber in New York, author of Serious Adverse Events and Uncensored History of AIDS, and David Crowe in Calgary, Alberta, president of the international organization Rethinking AIDS. We have some interesting guests for this podcast, the Nagel family in Minnesota, Steve, Cheryl, and daughter Lindsay, who went through some harrowing experience with the chemotherapy known as antiretrovirals. Hello, David. Hello, Celia. Thanks for letting me join you.
Thanks for being with us, Terry. We're very excited about this interview.
It's a pleasure to be back on. And Terry, you're new to the show, so why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a 62-year-old gay man in Washington, D.C., who stumbled on the fact that there was dissent from the single pathogen theory of AIDS just 3 years ago this month. I was in my early 30s when AIDS reared its head in the early 1980s, and I went 22 years without having a clue. And I'm a consumer of mainstream media. I teach journalism students about politics. I've been a political press secretary. But I knew nothing about the worldwide group of people who dissent from the single pathogen theory. And I have studied and researched, read for 3 years, and just last November I wrote a special report on HIV/AIDS, which I published. It's impossible to find a publisher in mainstream media at my own website, terrymichael.net, www.terrymichael, all one character string, .net. And if you're so inclined, you can read 8,000 words that I've written on what I think I've learned about the flaws in the single pathogen theory.
Terry, did you feel when you came across this information, was it instantaneous for you that this was important as opposed to preposterous, which is how most media people seem to react when they see it for the first time? Oh, yeah, I've heard that. That's ridiculous. You know, that
well, I actually ran across it on a blog reporting the case in Australia of a straight man who was being charged with having a lethal weapon in his body, HIV, and it just happened that the writer linked to Christine Majori's aliveandwell.org. And so I just, out of curiosity, clicked on the link, and that started my journey. I did not stop until I read every word on her site, and then I contacted her, and I asked her to come just 2 months later to speak to my journalism students in Washington about the importance of being skeptical about everything. I'd always told my students, if you're going to be skeptical, don't leave anything out. Well, Christine then really began to educate me. I read her book. I've now read 16 books. I've read scores of research papers. This is everything that, as I always say, the people who I discuss this with, I think I did everything that Tabo and Becky did. I educated myself. I did the reading. And you really have to do the reading to understand how science can go wrong.
Did you go on the internet like Tabo and Becky?
I think for the last 3 years, I would think there are a few days far in between that I have not been on the internet trying to find something to read about HIV and AIDS. I don't want to say I've become obsessed, but I want to become educated so that I can discuss this intelligently from the standpoint of somebody who was a journalism liberal arts major. I always joke that the average journalist wouldn't know the inside of a biology lab from a Labrador retriever. Mainstream media is science illiterate, and that's why they don't know the right questions to ask of these folks who claim that we're denialists, who claim that we're dangerous. So I wasn't going to be one of those mainstream journalists. I was going to be one who understood enough science be able to know what.
Yeah, I mentioned the internet because it used to be a real insult to say, well, he got all his information off the internet, as if, you know, you'd got everything you learned out of Penthouse magazine or something, which actually was not a bad source of information on this subject. But I think
that's where I first read about it. Yes. Was in Penthouse in 1986, actually.
I think that it was ironic that even when people were looking down their noses at people for getting information off the internet, things like PubMed, you know, the huge database of basically virtually every research paper, or at least the abstracts and citations of virtually every research paper since the 80s, is on the internet, and yet people who question a paradigm are considered to be irrelevant because they got a lot of information off the internet. Anyway, it's very interesting.
Well, I did both. I read 16 books. I, of course, have read Sylvia's book and all everything Sylvia's written. I thank you, David, for this aggregating site that you've maintained for so long, collecting so much information. My only criticism, obviously, of, and this is not a criticism, but of the stuff I see from dissidents on the internet is formatted in a way that makes it more difficult, I think, to convince people that it's serious science because it doesn't look like a science or a JAMA or a Lancet. But if you start reading the content is there, the science is there, the epidemiology is there. And, I think that really now with the arrival of Brent Leung's House of Numbers, hoping that it can get widespread, widespread distribution, that we can bring in a lot more people, the people who are reading in verse, who can see summarized in a 90-minute documentary all the things that the three of us have over the years been able to understand and be clued into as the anomalies of HIV/AIDS.
Yeah, by the way, President Thabo, former South African President Thabo Mbeki, was not reading on the internet. He was trawling the internet. Remember that word, David?
That doesn't sound like a
trawling.
Good thing,
does Every it? Every single time they described his journey, they called it trawling at late at night, as if they knew when.
Late
in the
at
day.
Night is suspect, too, isn't it?
He did his reading. Yeah, the condescension is very, very well developed.
Today, in episode 17, we're going to interview the Nagel family. Last week in episode 16, we had the fascinating story of Tommy Morrison, who tested HIV positive in 1996. His career as a boxer was destroyed. He went on the drugs for a while, found that they just made him sick. He got off the drugs. He took control of his life. He regained his health. But he still, to this day, is dealing with the social consequences of a positive HIV diagnosis. There are remarkable parallels with the fascinating story of the Nagels, which started when an American couple decided it would be a beautiful thing to bring a baby home, baby orphan home, from the wreckage of Ceausescu's Romania. Let's give them a call. Cheryl, Steve, and Lindsay, welcome to How Positive Are You? We're really happy that you can join us on our show tonight. And in lieu of introductions, perhaps you can just tell the story that started when you decided to adopt a little orphan girl from Romania.
Yes, so back in 1990, we decided to adopt a baby, and our social worker said that there are a lot of children in Romania. And so I went to Romania in October, and my mom came with me, kind of unusual maybe, but it was because they told us that we'd be gone for an indefinite amount of time. And so we went over, and we just had a friend of a very good friend helping us there. And we found Lindsay within 2 weeks in an orphanage. There was a satellite to a hospital over there, and she was very well taken care of, and we could see everything is very clean. And when we got back to the United, well, before we left Romania, actually, we had to have her tested because at the time they weren't allowing anybody with HIV into the United States. So then when we got back to the United States, we had her tested again because it's a test that they automatically do in the battery of it's like a whole series of tests. So here
her test in Romania was negative.
Right, the test in Romania was negative, so we were shocked, really, really shocked to find out that the test in the United States was positive. And so they followed up. This is just a screening test. They followed it up with two Western blots. And so we started her on medication right away when she was only 3 months old. And she stayed on medication, which was AZT, for 22 months. And towards the end of the time that she was on the medication, we were just tearing her hair out because she was experiencing severe leg pain and she was not eating very well. And the doctor kept telling us that, yes, these are symptoms of HIV infection. And we determined, because my dad called one night and he told us to read an article in the National Review that was written by Tom Bethel. And the article was written all about Peter Duisberg from Berklee College. And Peter Duisberg was a renowned virologist. Anyway, Duisberg was saying that HIV doesn't cause AIDS. And he said, even if you don't believe that, you really should not be on the drugs because the drugs are causing side effects that are so terrible that it has caused death in most people who stay on the drugs for any length of time. And so I thought, when my dad called me, I just thought, oh, yeah, that's really sweet, Dad, that you are telling us this. But, you know, everybody knows HIV causes AIDS. And our doctors certainly wouldn't give us a toxic drug. But as Lindsay's side effects from the medication became worse and worse, we thought we better contact Peter Duisberg. So we wrote to him, and he wrote back in 10 days with a large envelope full of articles out of journals, medical journals, that actually confirmed everything that he thought was that AZT can kill you, and in the meantime, you'll have these horrible side effects. So the day we got Peter Duisberg's letter, Steve and I decided to take Lindsay off the AZT, and she was just 2 years old and 1 month, and she almost immediately recovered from the leg cramps. And she started eating much more. She gained about 20% of her body weight in just a few months. And she seemed like a normal, happy child. And since then, we haven't given her any drugs for anything. The only thing we've done is given her vitamins. And she has seen a nutritionist off and on over the years.
And how many years ago was this? Is this 20 years ago?
Yes, Lindy has been drug-free for 17 years. It was just 17 years ago.
Steve, I wonder if you could pick up on part of this story, because I heard the two of you tell this when you spoke at the premiere of Brent Loewen's House of Numbers, and that was what happened to other children in Minnesota you were aware of in the same time period.
Well, there were... At that time, there weren't very many kids that were infants or in the childhood range, which ran from infants up to about 10 years of age. And they were basically all seen by the same doctor because there wasn't a high concentration of children that were HIV positive in Minnesota. And this doctor, we knew some of the families or some of the children personally because the doctors had made a network of people that are willing to to communicate with each other. So some of the kids we did know personally. This doctor has since, she has a web page on the internet, which she states that in 1994 she had 12 children under her care, which she claims was the total number of children with AIDS at that time. She had 13 in her care, and 12 of those children died in 1994. And by the Minnesota statistics, the AIDS statistics here, there was a total of 13 children listed as having AIDS in Minnesota. So that would mean that there was only one child that lived, and that was Lindsay, and we had taken her off from the drugs.
And all of those other children remained on the drugs until they died.
They were all under the same care of that doctor, and that was during the hit hard, hit early times with AZT, and they didn't, you know, when we first went to the doctor on our first visit, the doctor said, well, she'll probably be all right for about 6 months, and then you'll start going to the hospital quite often, and she will have a 20% chance to live to 2 years of age. So when you're given that type of news, especially when you have, you know, the child has just come home from Romania, and you go into the doctor, your first thought when they give you the drugs is not, you know, how toxic is this stuff? It's how fast can I get to the pharmacy to purchase the drug and get started on the drug? We literally covered the floor in the pharmacy at the hospital with baby blankets and everything that we were carrying at the time, because we sat right on the floor in the pharmacy and gave her first dose of AZT. So your first thought isn't, is this stuff toxic? It's just, you know, I've really got to get in and make sure I never miss a dose of it. She was, every 6 hours, she was given another dose, and that's how your brain works. You think that the doctors are working in your best interest.
I'm curious, did this doctor, when you took Lindsay off, try any extraordinary means to get you to put her back on the drugs, or even threaten to take you to Children and Family Services?
Well, we did. When we took Lindsay off the drugs, her T-cell counts flipped. So the doctor knew right away when she got the lab results back that we had taken her off from the drugs.
Yeah, the ratio had flipped. It's not the actual counts were well within the normal range, but the CD4, CD8 count was just the wrong ratio. And so we were expecting that because Lindy had only been off the AZT 3 weeks, but the doctor was saying, see what you've done? Now you've screwed up her blood work.
As if the numbers were all that counted.
You've screwed up her blood chemistry, I guess.
But did they threaten you, or did they try to coerce you into putting her back on the drugs in any way?
Yeah. Did you ever think you might lose her, that they might take her from your home?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The doctor called and he told our holistic doctor that if we didn't put Lindsay back on the drugs, she would find a family who would take care of her and put her on the AZT again. So the next day, which was, she called on New Year's Eve of all the days, and we realized that we wouldn't be able to talk to any attorney January 1st, so we waited till the 2nd, and we were right on the phone calling a family friend and who is a medical attorney, and he said, absolutely, that doctor can take that child out of your home. So you need to find a medical umbrella. In other words, another doctor who was a specialist in infectious diseases. You have to find another doctor who will see Lindsay without making you give her AZT. And we thought, well, that should be fairly simple. There, you know, we knew of at least 5 other doctors in the Twin Cities. And we called every single one of them, and we ended up calling pediatric and adult doctors, and none of them would agree. They would all say, well, if Dr. Hostetter said you have to give your child AZT, then we would have to do the same thing. So the attorney told us to try the Mayo Clinic. He said that would be what he would do. In fact, he said, if it were my daughter, I would take her down to the Mayo Clinic and set her on the floor and say, what would you have me do? And so Steve ended up calling the Mayo Clinic, and we didn't avoid calling them at first, but they're in Rochester, Minnesota, which is a good 2 hours away from our home. But we did end up going there because Steve talked to a doctor who said Sure, bring her on down. If she doesn't have any compromised lab results, I will be your doctor.
I'm curious.
Wow.
This original doctor that let's put quotes around it treated Lindsay. Have you confronted her in recent years and saying, "Look, we have a daughter whose life was spared here, and your other patients died"? Have you confronted her or just ignored her?
We've just ignored her. We did file a complaint with the Minnesota Board of Medical Doctors. It's, you know, like the medical health board
ethics,
here,
right.
In our state. And it was a 17-page thing that Steve wrote, and the response was almost nothing. They said it was like a one-page little letter with a paragraph, and it said, "Sorry, your doctor can, or your child was treated by a doctor, and all the other doctors that we've talked to would have treated her the same way."
Doctors protect their own.
Safety in numbers. If you all do the same thing, then it's what do they call it? State of the art.
Yes.
Best practices.
Best practice. Art. Yes.
Well, pediatric AIDS treatment came. It's really ex nihilo, right? Out of nothing. I'm not aware of any data that would suggest, never mind demonstrate, that a child, a newborn, if infected with HIV, would go on to develop AIDS and die within the period of time that they cited. David, you're really familiar with the whole body of data in AIDS since the beginning. Do you have any idea what they could possibly have been going on, or was it just the usual voodoo, basically?
Well, I don't think they had any data back then, and since then, there's quite a few studies that have shown that mothers that take AZT have babies that are sicker and more likely to die, and the litany of health problems with AZT has been enumerated, but what they've fallen back to is that in a few studies, AZT has been shown to reduce the number of babies who develop so-called HIV antibodies, and that's what they've placed everything on. But that really just justifies, I mean, if it's a justification for anything, it justifies giving AZT to the mother. A long-term health study of babies on AZT versus babies not on AZT, well, they would say ethically impossible. We can't do that study because, of course, AZT is a proven treatment.
I mean, it looks to me like what my discussions with Steve and Cheryl over many years, what they are approaching gradually is possibly the realization, and it's a horrific one, that Lindsay may be one of the only survivors, if not. It appears she may be the only, you'll correct me, Steve and Cheryl, if I'm wrong, she may be the only survivor from that era, pediatric AIDS treatment in the state of Minnesota. But I suspect she might be the only survivor in a broader geography than that.
The period of time from about 1988-89 until 95, when they lessened the dose, I don't think any child that was put on AZT, let's say in 1990, I don't think any of them survived. I've tried to do different phrases on the internet to find anybody, any story about any child that would fit into that age group that was HIV positive, and I haven't run across any. We haven't seen any. That's not to say there aren't any, but they were putting them on tremendous doses. They were just, you know, 2 years was a long time back then. I mean, people don't think about that now. They don't really remember that time because everybody's dead from that time. I mean, it wasn't just children. It was, you know, there were studies that showed that people that were put on AZT, 82% of them were dead within 4 years' time.
Well, the gay men who were placed on it almost always had presenting illnesses. Now, I realize Lindsay was really young, but did she show any sign of any illness or to your knowledge, did these other 13 children show any sign of any illness before they were placed on this highly toxic chemotherapy?
Well, Lindsay had absolutely nothing. I mean, we've got all the paperwork from there. Cheryl's working on a book right now on it, so we're kind of fresh with all of this stuff. But, no, there was, on her initial visit to the doctor, the first HIV-AIDS doctor in the cities here, absolutely everything was normal. And on that first visit, she was put on Sceptra before she had even had any other blood work or any other testing.
And what year was that? 1991.
Well, she was 3.5 months, so it would have been 91.
And by that time, there are almost certainly any physician who had her eyes open must have seen the toxicity of ACT in gay men. It's just rather amazing to me that a physician would have just automatically placed a child on a chemotherapy when there were many examples of gay men just dying quickly after they went on ACT.
Here's a paper from 1991, and this is treating children diagnosed with AIDS. So these are sick children with AZT. It says, this is New England Journal of Medicine, children treated with AZT continue to have bacterial and opportunistic infections. The effect of the drug on the frequency of these events could not be assessed because of the lack of a control group. One or more episodes of hematological toxicity, that's anemia, occurred in 61% of the children, and various different kinds of anemia. So they had evidence in 1991 that even for seriously sick children, it didn't really work, and it caused severe side effects.
I would suggest to you for your book, find this doctor and get her to answer a question of why she did this and what she thinks the outcomes indicate in her own mind.
Well, I've seen some of the letters these folks have been subjected to, as you can imagine, that you know the extraordinary, not just condescension, but outright accusation that they're killing their child, and I imagine there's a lot of very strong feelings there.
Give me your name.
It's probably not very
front.
Easy to confront this individual. Yeah, well, one thing about being an AIDS doctor or researcher is never having to say, I'm sorry, never having to say I was wrong. They never do that. They never do that. Never. And I think the feeling is that but I absolutely agree with you, Terry, and I've brought this up several times as well. That's my wish, that this doctor would be confronted, and actually I'd be deeply, deeply curious what she would say. Would she continue? Because this is a psychological study. I mean, it really is. This is Stanley Milgram stuff.
Well, it's like
stuff.
People who send 19 and 20-year-olds to war. They're always going to find a way to justify the war, because it's really hard to square in your own mind that you sent 19 and 20-year-olds to their death in the desert or their death in Afghanistan. So it's understandable that you're not going to find doctors who can face up to reality. I, as a gay man, I asked my gay doctor of the last 30 years, 2 years ago, I said, Rick, tell me in the last 10 years, how many men have come to you and presented with illness you would define as AIDS? He immediately said, 2 in 10 years. But I look at his waiting room, and I see the wasted faces and the distended stomachs, the humped backs, the thin limbs. He cannot bring himself to look at his patients and say, I did that
yes.
to them. So it would not be surprising to me if you could not get your doctor to
I have an idea, and that is we interview her on How Positive Are You?
David,
no,
I'm
we can
sure
try.
Let's try, though.
We'll get the more detailed information from Steve and Cheryl. But, Steve, I have a question for you. On your new website, which is called aztsucks.com, which I love that name, You have some tape recordings where you were phoning up doctors at like the National Institute of Health and other places and asking them about what CD4 count people were supposed to be, babies were supposed to be put on AZT. And it seemed from those interviews that there was a lot of confusion going on and a lot of contradictions. Do you want to describe what you found?
Well, it was clear that, because on the website, you'll see that there were two different doctors at the NIH that I talked to, and then one representative from Burroughs Wellcome. So all three of those people are represented in about 3 minutes' time. And my question, this was after we had taken Lindsay off from the drugs, because then then we started reading the material. So I was really amused with how we got to that position that they put her on the drug. So I called the NIH and Burroughs Wellcome and asked them, at what point would you put a child on AZT? Because when Lindsay was put on AZT, she had about 3,600 T cells, which was huge. It was way into the normal range. So as I talked to these people at both places, it was clear that they hadn't even really thought about that. Now, this was back in about 1993 that I did these interviews with them. And Burroughs Wellcome clearly stated that there was no T-cell count for children. There was in adults, but they didn't have a number for children. And the NIH, I talked to two different women on two different occasions from the NIH, and the numbers kept changing. It was clear that they didn't know exactly where they were at. It was not a question that they were familiar with, because they were grasping at straws, anywhere from 500 T cells to 1,750 T cells is where they would start. And the numbers kept varying in there, which seems like quite a huge spread. And it didn't seem like that difficult a question. I, from everything that we had read with adults, there were definite numbers at which you started AZT. And here, when you contacted the producer of the drug and the National Institute of Health, and they couldn't provide a clear answer.
That's interesting. Terry Michael, earlier in this podcast, before you joined us, was talking about a situation in Washington, D.C., where they want to start testing people and putting them on the drugs right away, which I think has been their dream all along. But you bring up an interesting point, that's basically what they were doing with babies, is they were taking perfectly healthy babies and putting them on AZT. There was no consideration of CD4 counts or anything else that stops at least some people from taking the drugs as adults.
No, it was clear that the doctor here in Minnesota, that all the children that were under her care were immediately put on Septra and AZT.
Explain what Septra is. I don't think many people have heard of Septra.
Well, from my memory, it's a bacteria stripper. It just, if you take
an antibiotic.
If you take it long enough, you won't have any bacteria in your body. So.
Yeah, it's a very potent antibiotic,
it's a broad spectrum antibiotic given to people when you really have a massive infection, or when the infection is spread around so many places, they just sort of take a shotgun approach to it, as opposed to a trying to specific. One thing I don't think we've talked about, and that is subsequent HIV testing after you got the initial positive results.
Mm-hmm.
Was Lindsay tested on a number of other occasions, and what happened?
Oh, absolutely. This is one thing that we didn't find out until 1995. But when Lindy, we started out with one doctor at the Children's Medical Center, and then we were kind of unhappy, very unhappy with her, because she was just kind of sloppy. And Pard, our pediatrician, just a general practitioner, recommended that we switch to the University of Minnesota because they had an international adoption clinic there, and the specialist was her thing was infectious diseases. So when we switched to the university, which was in November of 1991, she did a culture test. And in every time we had a meeting with her, taking Lindy in to have lab tests, she would tell us, yes, Lindy still has HIV. Well, on this occasion, in November of 91, she did a culture test. And this culture test was always portrayed to us as being the gold standard of tests. It is the test that will tell you if you are HIV positive or not for absolute certain. Okay.
Is that probably the P24 antigen test? Is that what
I'm not sure what it was testing, because the P24 antigen test was in addition to this one. That it may have been testing for P24. I don't know. But what happened in 1991 is that she told us it was positive, but in 1995, in this lab work that we had never seen before, it had come back negative. And all this time, we were basing Lindsay's diagnosis and treatment on that culture test. And so we were flabbergasted to find out it was negative.
How about antibody tests later on? Did you ever have any antibody tests later on?
Yes, she had many Western blots and just plain what they call ELISA tests. And then we had her tested by four different specialists, the one at the Children's Hospital, the one at the University Hospital, and a hospital in Chicago. It was the Rush Hospital. And then again by the Mayo Clinic. And so four of those doctors confirmed that she had HIV infection, that's what they'd call it.
The reason I ask you that is that a lot of people will say, well, yes, she's healthy now because she really didn't have a positive test.
Mm-hmm.
Those
four professionals are all wrong. They must not know what they're doing then.
Or you could take your pick of the test, because she's had two or three negatives, and then the rest were positive. So
she's had negative antibody tests.
Well, the first one in Romania was negative.
Yeah, probably an antibody
probably
test.
Probably
ELISA,
right?
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if we could ask, depending on how you want to go with this. I just wanted to ask Lindsay about how her health has been since she went off of AZT.
All right, here comes Lindsay.
Okay. Lindsay, are you there?
Hi, Lindsay.
Hello.
Hi, Lindsay. It's Terry. I want to ask you, since now you can't necessarily remember yourself when you were 3 or 4 years old, but since you became a self-aware child and then young adult, how has your health been?
I think I've had pretty normal illnesses, as anyone else, the flu and chicken pox, all that normal stuff. Nothing.
But
I've never been hospitalized for anything, so.
Did your friends that you grew up with, did they know you were HIV positive? Did they know your story? Or when did you start letting people know?
I didn't tell anyone, growing up until, I told a couple people in high school, and then now since the movie and everything, I've been more open to telling people.
How did the people in high school react?
Most of my friends, they just kind of, it didn't really, faze them at all. They were just kind of okay. I don't know. It didn't really seem to bother them. They're shocked by what had happened, but it wasn't, a big deal to them at all.
Lindsay, I wanted to ask you, I know you met Peter Duisberg for the first time in Nashville when House of Numbers premiered. What was that experience like to meet this person who saved your life?
That was probably one of the best days of my life, to meet Peter Duisberg. There's no feeling to describe how I felt, actually.
Really? So he was in your consciousness. He was somebody who you knew who he was, but you'd never met him, and you knew what he had done, how he had impacted your life. You knew about him. I mean,
yep,
you were very conscious of him. But this was the first time you met him.
My mom told me about Peter Duesberg, and he saved my life. But he didn't tell me, like, what had happened, really. It was just, he saved my life.
And Steve and Cheryl, what was it like for you two? I think that
actually
was the first time you met him as well. Is that right?
One, but I met him out in Oakland. And it was pretty emotional because I talked to him several times, and you deal with the emotion of that part, but I also have quite an emotion towards what he has sacrificed to do this. I mean, he's gotten nothing positive, at least financially, out of this. I mean, he pretty much lost a big part of what his career could have been because of the stance that he took. So, he's out there saving lives one at a time, and he's one of the, the handful of people that have sacrificed their career that wouldn't had to. I mean, he didn't have to go down that road. He could have gone off and kept studying cancer or whatever, but he's stood by what he has said ever since I've known him. His story has absolutely never changed, and that's a lot more than you can say about the establishment. The establishment has changed at least yearly on what HIV is and what AIDS is and the whole situation. They keep changing things to fit what the changing weather is out there for them. And Peter has stuck completely by what he said, and it's all still true today. We've been dealing with this for 19 years, we haven't found anything that he said that isn't true, and we haven't found anything that he's ever reversed himself on.
I don't know whether we're ready for this, David and Celia, but I want to really hear what happened to Lindsay at school today. Now, I don't know whether you, Steve, and Cheryl want to tell that story, if we can let Lindsay start out by telling the story, and then maybe you want to comment on it. Lindsay, are you still on the line?
Yeah, Lindsay should go ahead and, if you're up to it, tell them what went on with school, because it's a pretty, it's something that, we've had to deal with for years. It's a mindset that we had to deal with for years. So go ahead and tell them, Lindsay.
Okay.
Lindsay, what class were you in when this occurred today?
Well, I was in social studies, but we had a guest speaker today, yesterday. And so it was like on, he was from the teen clinic, and he was talking about sexually transmitted diseases. And so he was doing his little talk or whatever, and what happened? That we were talking about.
He asked you a question, right?
Yeah. Well, we were filling out these like worksheets or whatever for different things, and it was a true and false question, and so he called on me, and of course I get an HIV/AIDS question, and it was true or false. So the question was something like, does HIV/AIDS affect teens? And so I said, well, I know the answer that you want is true, but for me, I don't believe that HIV causes AIDS. And then he was kind of just like taken back by that, and he was like, okay, well,
do you think he knew who you were? Do you think he knew who you were?
I don't think so at all. I think he was just like, who is this girl? So, like, why is she saying this? So he just kind of went off, like, kind of fluffed it off or whatever. And then,
how did the class react?
No one really said anything. But the class never said anything. They just, someone in the next class that I had was like, well, what did you mean when you said that? So I told him, and then he was like, okay, like, nothing really too big. He wasn't extremely shocked or anything. But then today, I went back to my class, and the teacher right away, then there's like kids everywhere in this classroom, and he calls me up to his desk and tells me that the guest speaker came up to him yesterday after everything and told him that there was someone in the class who didn't believe that AIDS existed. And so he told me today, my teacher, that that people do die from AIDS, and like he's basically telling me that I was crazy for thinking anything other than that. And so I kind of got upset and told him, well, this affects me personally. Like, I cut him off from what he was saying. And so I told him my story. I told him to go to my dad's website, and he watched the videos. And he went to the House of Numbers. And so he was, after that, he was pretty surprised, I think. And
so he didn't know your story either. He just, this was all by chance. Well, okay, let's have your dad and mom tell us what they've done or are going to do.
Okay.
Well, we went in. Lindsay was pretty upset when she called me, and I immediately was ready to go. I mean, we've just dealt with this. I mean, everybody that's HIV positive, I can't imagine anybody going into a room of cancer patients, and even if it's a deadly type of cancer, just immediately making sure
great
everybody
analogy.
In the room knows that you're going to die from this cancer. They do that all the time with people that are HIV positive. In fact, when Lindsay was 4 years old, she was sitting on the floor at the Mayo Clinic, and the doctor said to us, because we were having a conversation with her about Lindsay, the doctor said, well, she may live to be 7 years old, but she definitely won't live to double digits. Now, the kid's sitting right on the floor at 4 years old. I mean, this is how HIV positive, no matter if you're 4 years old or 40 years old, this is how you're treated, and nobody else gets treated that way. So I was plenty wound up. And I definitely wanted the confrontation, and we got to the school, and the teacher was very low key about it, and he was kind of apologetic about it, and so it didn't end up being a blown up situation. In fact, he wants Lindsay to do a report for the history class on this topic.
You know, this whole question of hope is something that why we really miss Christine, because she was an apostle of hopefulness and always talked about how this religion, this HIV religion, wanted to just tell you, you're all going to die, and the only way you're going to be saved is to take our sacraments. And I think that you can't underestimate, as a gay man, knowing what the hopelessness was in the early 1980s, the psychogenic effects of that hopelessness had to have made people immunosuppressive. I'm sorry if I'm sounding emotional about this, but just outrages me when you have this situation where you just offer not only no hope, but really push the depression and hopeless feelings.
Well, it's a psychic assault. It's a very serious. I think it's a crime. I'm using the word a little bit loosely. It's a psychic crime that they've committed, and this is what I've been fighting since 1986, 1987, right about that time. There was a movement, actually, in the gay movement in New York, or a movement among gay men, led by Michael Callan and a few others. There weren't very many of them, but they were trying in the very early years to introduce hope as a legitimate, like a pinnacle of the language of AIDS. And it just got crushed and knocked over. It was just not part of the juggernaut. It was just anathema. And my feeling about this has always been, it hasn't changed in 24 years. I sometimes bring up the myth of Prometheus. Prometheus gave life to humans and gave, and he said, I blinded them to the day of their deaths so that they would aspire. So the Greeks were very clear about this, that we all have a right to remain blinded to the day and the manner of our deaths. And without that fundamental human right, we can't aspire. And aspire really means to breathe, but also what we hear in the word aspire, to have aspirations, to have dreams, simply to live. You can't live if you have been given a death sentence. They have to revoke this death sentence
for
the HIV positive population of the world.
Being told they're positive and just lose it, lose hope. If I'm not saying I found that many people who are suicidal, but I think the dysfunctional behavior that results from it, we know that psychogenic effects of fear and depression and anxiety are detrimental to your physical health. And why this entire establishment wants to present this hopelessness, and unless they simply are out of their minds as physicians, as clinicians, who understand and will almost tell any other patient, well, you have to have a positive attitude here. But on this, no, just take our drugs.
They left no wiggle room, and this is rare in any disease. They left absolutely
like
no wiggle room. They have total power.
Surrounding your coming out, which I think sort of happened around the opening of House of Numbers. What has the response been of the people you've encountered, any media you've encountered, scientists, doctors, general public? How have people reacted to you coming out at this time and starting to tell your story?
Well, a good example of it, we were in La Crosse. It was the largest group that has seen the House of Numbers all at one time. There were 700 college students there. And the Q&A after the show lasted over 2 hours. There were a couple of biology teachers, three biology teachers in the class or in the audience that at the beginning of the Q&A wanted to dominate and to get after the director. And they, every time they got up, they got shouted back down by the students. And the students said, you know, this is our forum, and we want to hear, you know, we can make the decisions here for ourselves. So 98% of the 700 students that were at that premiere all had a very positive outlook on this, and they were very positive towards us. I think Cheryl probably had a little bit different case when she went to Nashville the second time. You might want to elaborate on that. Cheryl?
Yes. In the Nashville screening, we had a panel up front, and Celia was there also, so she can kind of fill in the blanks here but if I miss. But we had a panel up front, and it included Lindsay and me and Peter Duisberg and several professionals in this business, I mean, who represent our views. And one of the women in the audience started rattling off this thing, and I wasn't sure if she was reading it or saying it, but she was so rude and crude, and she used the F word three different times, and particularly in regard to Lindsay, you know. And I just about ran up the aisle and strangled
I don't blame
her.
You.
She was just, I couldn't even hear her very well, but what she was saying was just awful. And there was the pal that she was with was a doctor who got up and read a letter that was written by supposedly the professional healthy people at the university right across the way there. Is it Vanderbilt University? And none of them had even seen the movie, so how could they write a letter to us and protest and say that the interviews in the movie were coerced by Brentley Young and he somehow twisted what they said? It was just a bunch of bogus nonsense they were spewing out. was very, very upsetting.
It was fascinating. What I was doing up in that moment was trying to conduct a sort of ad hoc psychological fact experiment. And I said to this ranting, raving woman, you think HIV causes AIDS, and I understand that. And you presumably understand that there are people who, based on their experience, have not found that to be the case. So let's assume, okay, we see that differently. But can we at least agree, do you see Lindsay sitting there? She's sitting at the end of the table, beautiful, healthy. Can we at least agree she's sitting there? I literally was down to that. Do we agree? Do we all see her? And that's when she went nuts. And she called me an effing liar.
It's not just an industry, it's a religion. And when people believe on their religion and believe in their sacraments, you can't shake their faith. And they do crazy things. A lot of people do crazy things in the name of religion, including flying off the handle.
But this is very significant, this moment, I have to say, because if the entire paradigm were rational, if it were rational at all, that woman and all the people around her would have reflected, oh, I just remembered something she said. Very condescendingly, she turned, she sort of tilted her head and looked toward Lindsay, and she said, listen, I'm glad you're alive. I'm very happy you're alive. And something about that just offended me so much, because we all knew what was coming next, you know. I'm not going to take your story and alter my belief system one iota. But if you're a rational person, what you do is you say, well, let me listen to your story and let's try to figure out what's going on here. Instead, they rant, they rave, they scream, they have accused the Nagels of fault, you know, that Lindsay's not really positive and she never was positive. And of course, they did that to Christine as well. Once upon a time, it was that same woman. But that's another story. But to see up close that they cannot deal with the process of fact-finding and the process of figuring out what's going on, the truth-seeking process.
And seldom accept even the most obvious truth if it would oblige them to admit the falsity of conclusions which they have woven into the fabric of their lives. It's a religion. Well, I guess I'm looking at my watch, and we probably come near the end, and I want to say that I'm looking forward to your book, Nagels.
Thank you.
When are you going to have it out?
I'm still in the early stages, you know.
Really?
I'm almost kind of embarrassed, but, you know, it's probably a good, almost half done, so.
Do you have a title for it yet?
No, I haven't. I'm leaving it up to you to give me an idea.
I'd like to ask one final question of each of you, and that is, what is your vision? You've gone through all this. Why did you go through this? What was it all about? And what do you hope for now? What's your dream now? They came out, thank God. Yes, but where can we go from here? What can we do with this dreadful? I mean, it's really an awful wisdom to have learned, and it's a very painful and difficult message to give to the world. How are you going to go about that? What are your thoughts and plans about where you want to go from here?
I'd really like to see Steve. I should let him talk for himself, but he's kind of seeking justice for Lindsay, because she was almost killed by these people. And you just have to, what I'd really like to see is a restudying of the original hypothesis and that says HIV causes AIDS, because we know that it doesn't, it hasn't in this case, and we'd like other people to have at least a fighting chance.
Yeah, so why don't we go to Steve for closing words, like what do you want for the future, Steve? And then we'll let Lindsay have the last word.
Well, I think for me, I've been told I shouldn't be revengeful, so I've switched it to redemption. I want redemption for the people that were dead. I want redemption for the Celia Farbers and the Duisburgs, and for us. that we get put back whole again. I don't know that that can happen, but I'm going to come as close to that as I can, and I'm going to probably spend the rest of my days, going towards that goal. There's been too many people that have had all of that taken away from them, whether it's their lives or their careers or just their mental state of mind.
Or their children.
It goes, this is a, you know, it's a very personal thing towards me, so redemption is my goal.
Can I ask Lindsay the last question? I know this is a great burden to the public as a teenager, so instead of asking you really, you know, how you want to handle this, so you're certainly welcome to discuss that. What do you think of your parents and what they have done here for you and what they're trying to do now?
Well, I'm happy with the choice that they made about keeping it kind of quiet as I was growing up. And now that I'm an adult, I think it's the right time to share my story and let people know what happened to me, so if they're in the same position, they can get help.
It'll be tough, I imagine, but you're willing to do it, and we all applaud you for that.
Yeah, you folks are a real inspiration. We all we all get a lot of bad news all the time, and you folks are just the best news.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us today.
A wonderful, inspiring story.
Your story, it really is incredible.
We appreciate
an inspiring story, and work hard on that book, Cheryl, because we want to read it.
Okay, she's not online, but
okay, I'm now. I'm right here.
Okay.
I just said work hard on that book because we want to read it.
Oh, thank you. I sure will. Okay. I'm moving as quickly as possible.
Okay. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thank you. To be continued. Well, this story moves me so deeply on so many levels. I've been aware of it for many years, and it just continues to grow and flower. And I admire these folks more than I can say. I think this is a fairy tale almost kind of story. There's something very mythical in it. The idea of this child coming out of a totally hopeless, dismal dictatorship and you know, coming to the land of freedom. And she still had to get past, yet another dictatorship, an invisible dictatorship. And she chose the right parents. And all these incredible flukes, like these passes that happen, that the grandfather, Cheryl's father, happened to be reading that article by Tom Bethel in the American Spectator about Peter Duisberg, that it caught on his mind, that he didn't just dismiss it, that he then mentioned it to Steve and Cheryl, and that their minds were receptive, and that they wrote to Peter, and Peter wrote them back. And we've all seen the letter because we've seen House of Numbers, and Peter's letter is also extraordinary. It's written in his own hand, and his language is so crystal clear and Duisbergian. And he said, if you don't take your daughter off that drug, she will die like Kimberly Bergalis. And one thing we didn't get to discuss in the interview is Steve told me in one interview that I did with him at one point, sometime within the last year, that when he saw Kimberly, the fact that Duisberg mentioned Kimberly Bergalis was very significant to Steve, because when Steve saw Kimberly Bergalis on television, televised supposedly dying of AIDS in her hospital bed, she was on at least three nukes, AZT, DDI, and D4T, I think, and she was drooling. And he recognized that, for he grew up on a farm, and the farm animals, when they had accidentally eaten poison, they looked, that he recognized that, the drooling, the facial paralysis, and particularly the drooling. So he understood when he saw Kimberly Brigalis that she had been poisoned, that AZT was poison. So all these things had to sort of connect in so many people's minds together as a family, as a community, for this miracle. That is what this is. This is a miracle survival.
I have to say that as someone who
one child survived.
So much later than both of you, only 3 years, I get frustrated from time to time about, is it possible to break through this religious mindset, this horrible taken on faith, inability to see with people's own eyes what these drugs do, what this depressing hopelessness does to people's lives. I felt it today when I was talking to Dr. Jay Levy, who seemed like a reasonable man at the beginning, but when I sort of disclose I'm a dissenter at the end, he starts using words like dangerous. My thinking is dangerous here. But when I hear a moving story, like Lindsay Nagel's story and the Nagel story, then it sort of gives me new energy to go on and to try to fight this, because this is destroying so many lives. People I know, like a friend of mine in New York who's 50 years old and was a picture of health, has been on these drugs for 10 or 15 years. 4 years ago, he had a stroke, then he had a heart attack, and his HIV doctor had the audacity to tell him it was the HIV that caused his heart attack. Anything.
It's insane.
Is that heart attack spelled H-A-A-R-T by any chance?
Yes. That's exactly what caused this heart attack. David?
Yeah, I think one of the things I was thinking about as this was going on was Peter Duisberg. Not only did he have all this information, but he spent so much time, he's taken so much of his own time to respond to so many letters and emails of these desperate people like the Nagels. I have the sense that science, modern science, wants to have a firewall around it, that the unwashed general public is not allowed in, and that they don't go out, that their science is done hermetically sealed away from normal life. And I think Duisberg saw that what he was finding, that his findings about AZT had a direct impact on people's lives. It had a direct impact on killing people, destroying their lives, taking children away from parents. And he felt a responsibility to act on that. It's kind of like journalists who believe that they are completely without opinions and completely unbiased and create this firewall from real life. Science can't be like that, or it becomes inhumane. And I think that's why Duisberg is such a hero in this story, is because he's such a human being as well as a brilliant scientist.
Well, I have a thought on that. Perhaps I'm stating the obvious, but before Peter Duisberg was a retrovirologist, he was, of course, a chemist. That's the first thing he was, a chemist. All these guys are chemists first. And it was Peter Duisberg, the chemist, who addressed this family's question. This chemical is a crude chemical, AZT. You don't have to be, it wasn't really a question of medicine in my mind. It was a question of chemistry and biochemistry. Biology is the study of life. And he basically said that chemical, no two ways about it, it's a DNA chain terminator. It destroys the synthesis of life. So the way he just says it, straightforwardly, and doesn't get caught up in all the kind of neuroses of the ethics of medicine. There's something really fascinating about that, and that is, of course, why he is so unpopular, as well as why he is so popular. He actually says what he sees and what he thinks.
So amazing how HIV doctors have no hesitation in prescribing these broad spectrum cell killers, but these same doctors would tell a patient, well, you have to be really conservative about using antibiotics or they'll become useless. Their own clinicians' eyes just don't want to see reality, don't want to see the truth, because, to use that famous phrase, they can't handle the truth. they have been speaking harshly or poisoning people for years, and they're not going to come to terms with the fact they've been doing that. Well, thank you very much, Celia and David, for putting this together. You have, as I say, been at this for years. I'm a newcomer, and I really was moved by this, and will step up.
Yeah, it's let's thank the Nagels not only for being on our podcast, but for being brave enough to come out. They could have easily kept this a secret to ensure the safety of their own life. They didn't have to do what they're doing, so I certainly applaud them for this.
Okay, well, until next time, I really want to, again, applaud both of you in carrying on this work and doing it for so many years.
And I think what we're going to do here at How Positive Are You is piece our way to the truth, which none of us have yet. This is an enormous puzzle. We have pieces of the truth, but we don't have the whole picture. And I believe that the way to do it is human story by human story. I'm interested in talking to scientists and philosophers and writers and journalists and everybody. We need everybody. But I think there's nothing quite so powerful as human stories. That's the highest density of truth.
If listeners have stories they want to hear, I think we would certainly welcome that input.
Definitely. And thanks to all of our listeners. And we'll hear you. We'll look forward to you joining us again on the next How Positive Are You? Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Yeah, stay with us.